Join us as we gather around the hedge, where we dig into technology, business, and culture with the finest minds in computer networking.
Well, hello, Tom. Glad to see you are back with us on the hedge.
Yep.
You don't seem to miss very many, but every now and then you can't seem to make it to the hedge to talk to us. We miss you when you're not here.
Thanks.
Just to make you feel better. And today with us, we have Scott Morris, Uber geek. He just waved. You can't see it, which is fine. You don't want to see him wave anyway. It's probably not a good thing to watch Scott wave.
I have a face for a podcast, let me tell you.
Awesome. So the topic for today is underutilizing people, because that's just like an interesting topic in general that we tend to do a lot in the networking world or in the engineering world. For whatever reason, and I think part of this is what I would call instrumentarianism, to jump right into the philosophy or the almost the commodification of work output, and that we just measure. We have a measurement culture in engineering. If you can't measure it, it didn't happen. It's like there's no picture, it didn't happen. In engineering, if you didn't measure it, it didn't happen. And I think that tends to lead us to the perspective that people are just replaceable units, just like routers. So Tom, riff. I mean, I know you've got something to say about this.
Sure. Well, I guess my take on it is everybody really is replaceable. There's not a single person working for anybody or even for themselves is not replaceable in the world. But at the same time, nobody is replaceable.
Wait, just a second. So you're going to fire yourself?
Well, there's that potential.
Okay.
Going to put myself on a pip.
All right, then. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's all right. So I think that the vast majority, maybe all of us, are some percentage underutilized by our employers or by our company. I think that it's a management challenge to help people to perform at their best and to use all the talents that they have. And I think part of what drives that is the sort of lowest common denominator thinking that is present in hiring all the time. And I know Scott's got some other comments on this, but
Let's back up. What does that mean? Lowest common denominator? What do you mean when you say that? Like when you say it's a lowest common denominator thinking in hiring, what are you getting at there? So that,
well, I just think that there's a, of necessity, if you're going to hire, a position from a pool of applicants, you have to say these are the minimum requirements, the bottom cut score below which you won't hire. And so what ends up happening is that's how you end up thinking about your organization, I think, is that your engineers met a certain minimum bar and that's what they're capable of. But the fact is most engineers are capable in along several dimensions of far more than whatever your minimum bar was. And that, I guess my theory is that additional capacity, that additional capability is almost always latent and unused by the organization.
It's interesting because that actually possibly relates back to the concept of a minimally qualified candidate when you're doing certifications, right? So that's, you know.
Well, no, but right? Hiring practice is more like CCNA required, CCIE preferred.
Right. So, and I think part of this, though, I'm just going to be very mean here and say that part of it, I think, is related to pure outright laziness.
See, I'd even go a step further and say that it's greed.
Oh, you know, okay.
People want to fall the lowest common denominator to meet a particular contract and, you know, put the body in place for that at the lowest possible price point. So therefore, whatever rates they have, they're making more money at. And whether they go above and beyond, there's no incentive or motivation for it.
Now, of course, that's a view from the perspective of, I don't want to say a body shop, but kind of a body shop, right?
Yeah,
a consulting position, right? Yeah. A consulting company. Now, in an average enterprise, you still run into that, though. So I wouldn't want people to think that this is just something
that
happens.
Well, I mean, yes and no. So, I mean, if you think about the idea that, and I mean, I've seen it too many places in enterprise environments also, where, you know, somebody is hired and the job description that was put out for it, or the salary range that was approved or whatever, is so far, you know, out of date or off base or whatever, that the only type of candidates they're going to get are inherently the less experienced, or, you know, people desperate to need a job, or who barely fill some minimum requirement that was set out when that job description came out. I don't think it's necessarily any different in the enterprise world. I think it happens less often, you know, just because they're not a body shop. So it's not like I have this contract that I need 20 new people. You know, you get one position that only emptied up because the last guy quit. You know, so it's a little bit different in terms of quantity, but I don't know if the thought process is any different when you break it down.
Yeah, I don't know that it happens less often. I actually wonder about that, because I think between recruiting and the folks on the front line and us not knowing how to interview people properly, frankly, just to be honest, I think it's probably, yeah, I know, I just did that, didn't I? So, yeah, I mean, so Tom, I think you had some more there you were about to throw out.
The interview thing is interesting. If you don't have skill to interview, and who among us would? We don't do it often enough to get good at it, right? But if you don't know how to interview, then you can't really discover what someone is capable of or what their potentials might be. All you can really discover, and maybe even you can't do this, but all you can really discover is, do they meet enough of the bullet points in the job description that you're not going to get in trouble for hiring that person? That's literally all the information you can get if you're not good at interviewing. And
you might not even get that, by the way.
Right. Right. So it's a crapshoot, right? Interview is a crapshoot. It always will be, because it's not something we will ever get good at. I'm just pessimistic that we'll ever get good at it. But that's okay, because as long as you can get a minimally qualified person in the door, I think that they have excess capability that you didn't know about. And the management challenges, can you leverage that for something, for some benefit for the organization? That's what I think is kind of undiscovered territory for us.
That's kind of a different place, though, to get into it. So, I mean, you've got one is the hiring side, which I'll call the, you know, pre-employment stage. You know, finding that person and deciding yes or no they can start. Whether or not they can do anything above, beyond, or anything else really doesn't matter. They've met those requirements, so yes, they can start. It becomes another person's responsibility, job, what should occur to identify, you know, yes, this is a great fit for this position, and they can do other things. Now, what do I do with those other things? Again, is kind of that next step. Because you may very well have management out there. I mean, you can be the greatest exchange admin in the world, and that's what I hired you for. The fact that you can also design networks and do telecom and do everything else in there, I mean, that's entirely up to that person or that group somewhere in there to not only identify it, but decide to do something about it. I would also say that it's partially a responsibility of the person. That if you have additional skills, at least that you find valuable and interesting, you know, it's kind of up to you to go, hey, guess what? I can do other things. I can, you know, add this, or hey, I could do that. Or, you know, I've seen that we do all these things, and I'd like to try to help that out over there because I think I can. And I think it becomes two-sided at that point, not just the employer, but the employee, as far as saying that, you know, I'm interested in this. Because just because you have, you know, I'll take a fun one, because occasionally I get, you know, recruiters calling me up about my DevOps experience. So let me tell you, I can do some coding. If you're looking at me to write code like from the ground up, that's not going to happen. Or it would not be very good. But I mean, from a resume standpoint, I can probably fill some minimum check marks. But it's not the right placement for somebody like me. But that would be, again, kind of up to me to say, you know, I may do this, and I may fit your minimum requirement, I'm in. Maybe that's my end of the company or whatever. Maybe that's my goal. But now that I'm here, guess what? All these other things that I can do.
Yeah, I'm with you. That it's, and I would say it's actually probably more of the person's responsibility than the company's. And really, it's ultimately all your responsibility as an engineer to take your career where it needs to go. Yes. But even at the company, it's still a shared responsibility for sure. It's definitely not all the company's job to find that gap.
Never count on somebody else to do the right thing for you.
Right.
Oh, I think we should put that on a mug. we could call it a Scottism.
There you go.
But I think it leads to some sort of pathological behaviors, though. This idea that a person cannot be utilized above whatever the minimum bar is. Like I've seen this in places where I've worked that, you know, somebody starts to gain a skill, they start to be proficient at something, and they say, well, this relates to my job, I want to do it. And they go to their manager or boss or whatever and say, hey, I want to do this thing. And their manager's like, that increases the risk for me quite a bit. No, that's not your job. Don't do that. And, you know, the problem there is that the person's asking for permission. That's, you know, you don't get super far in life asking for permission, in my opinion.
It's always easier to ask forgiveness than permission.
Right. But if that manager had a different mindset and said, you know, there's some unused capacity here that I'm not seeing, and this person wants to do something.
Let me go back to what you said, though, because you said that manager saw risk in it. And I mean, realistically, that is part of a management job, is to assess risk. So if there is actual risk in doing something or expanding on something, then I mean, I can see why that might be frowned upon. Now, question is there really risk, or is somebody just like, yeah, but I think somebody's going to complain to me because you're doing something different? And I mean, you know, the perceived risk versus actual.
Oh, but still, but that's stuff. Still risk. That's still risk for the manager.
Yeah, but that's stupid risk.
I'm not saying it's a good risk evaluation.
It's a dumbass factor.
But it's still risk. It is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. I mean, no one gets fired for buying certain brands. I mean, there's, you know, there's that in every industry now, by the way. You know, it's not just.
Till you run out of money.
Yeah, till you run out of money. It's not just networking. We seem to think that started in networking, and it really, really didn't, by the way.
No. IBM would be the first to know.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody gets fired for buying IBM. That was the old saying. That's where it came from. And then IBM had the things on the counters that said think, right? Everybody got a little thing on there. I don't know if it actually worked, though. Maybe it didn't. Just telling everybody to think. I'm not sure that's as effective as other ways of getting people to think. But, I mean, it is a risk for the manager in some sense, because they are saying, well, you normally do this, but I'm going to allow you to go do that. It's valid. Is it right?
I mean, you know, and I guess, again, it depends on your perspective or where you're at. So, you know, my view as running a company and having a bunch of consultants working for me is, to me, that translates into additional things that I can, you know, do for or sell to my customers, or new and exciting things that I can, you know, pick up new customers that I hadn't been able to before. So it translates to a monetary side of things for me. In corporate environments that I've been in, that I've worked in, a lot of it was really viewed the same way, is because if I can increase efficiency, do cost savings, do, you know, new projects or things that hadn't been anticipated before, if I can find either an ROI or just a good purpose in general for it, then that does well, not just for the company, but for me as a manager. So my employees doing better things, they're happier with what they're doing, so they raise themselves up in that aspect. I, as a manager, seeing that and expanding the horizons of it, you know, work my way up that ladder as well. And in theory, everybody gets a benefit from it. I mean, I'm sure that there are always, you know, examples contrary to that as well. You know, sucky companies, but you know, I guess they exist out there.
I'm sitting here thinking about, there was a company I worked with not too long ago, and I was talking to someone who works a lot more with the company than I did. I was brought in to talk about a particular technology or something. And when I walked out of the room, they were like, oh my gosh, you know, you just blew them away with all these ideas and stuff. And that's awesome. I said, so what do you think the possibility is that they're going to adopt what we're talking about, what we spent time talking about? And he said, honestly, zero.
And I'm like, that's a company problem.
I was like, okay, so now you just made me feel awesome. Just to tell you, you just made me feel awesome, right? That I've anyway, whatever. So He said, no, he said, look at it from their perspective. They run a large company, a large organization that if they do what you suggested, then there is some possibility that they are going to fail. And if they fail, it is their downside. And if they do not fail, they don't really, there's no, the bonus structure and stuff inside the company isn't such that they're going to get anything for it.
Well, and but that again is a corporate culture problem. But I mean, yeah, same type of idea. Always be careful what you incent people to do because they will do exactly that.
Yeah.
Right. You know, good side or bad side, you know, whether they look at it and say, well, I'm not going to get anything for that. Why would I suggest it? That to me is just as much of a problem. But it's different than somebody being a cog. That is really a management problem, but an upper management problem of not incenting people correctly for, you know, finding new and exciting lines of business. You know, I mean, diversification is not, is just one of those great things for lines of business that has been really popular lately. You know, I see lots of things talking about, your multiple sources of income and all this, all this other stuff, not putting all your eggs in one basket, if you will. And if you're limiting everybody on that, if you from the top down are forcing that behavior, which really translates to what Tom started with here, then that's a corporate problem.
Yeah, and that's not necessarily like it's not wrong. We're not talking about moral things here. We're just saying the outcome that you'll get is pretty much predictable. Yeah. Like if you you're not likely to succeed fabulously if you do least common denominator thinking. But if you want to succeed fabulously, this is where I think if you want to succeed fabulously, then I just think that there's a lot of potential out there in engineers specifically that could be used, like what you're talking about, Scott, you know, new lines of business. These are things that an executive might not ever see because he's not close enough to the details, he or she's not close enough to the details. But yeah, the people making things probably are and most likely are. And to me, that's the thing that I think is really interesting. But how many people know how to extract that value, how to even to open up the engineer's eyes themselves? Like most of us have potentials we don't even know about. And corporate culture doesn't seem to be the place to find where you can be fabulous, right?
No, that's true. But I mean, even in the last positions I've had, my goal as managing was always to try to, you know, motivate people to do something new and interesting. You know, I find ways to do it, but the whole thing is, you know, kind of like a general work stuff. You know, if you don't like what you do, you're probably not going to be doing it very long. You know, it's just, if it's a job, you know, I'm going to work today. Oh God. You know, then you're going to be looking for something else. You're going to be sitting there in your downtime, hunting the job boards, doing whatever, you know, on company time and all of those arguments for things. If you enjoy it or playing solitaire, but I mean, but I don't know. I do that sometimes too. And I like my job. But you know, everybody needs a little mental escape now and then. But you know, on the other hand, if you enjoy what you're doing or, you know, you're getting, I mean, hopefully rewarded financially for it as well, but that again is a different conversation for it. But if there's something that interests you and you feel that you can grow or have that ability to go, you know, hey, I'd really like to do this. You know, it's funny, just last week I had one of my employees that I had a conversation with. He's like, well, you know, I mean, so I want to do this. I'm like, okay, so I mean, that sounds kind of cool. What do you think we can do with that? You know, as a company, that's kind of a sidetrack. So not that I'm saying no, but I want you to take a moment to think about how are we going to sell that? How are we going to do that? Or what benefit is it going to bring to everybody? You know, if we can find a way to do that, I am more than happy to pay for, you know, your education in doing that and you know, figuring that part out about there, you know, keeping the employee happy, keeping them interested, keeping stuff. But I want to get them thinking the same way, mostly, again, because I'm smaller company. I mean, I got, you know, 40 some odd engineers now, but we're still at the point of, you know, being a small enough company that I want consultants to have that view of not what's just good for me individually, but what's good for the company, because they are all related. I know the larger company you get, there's more separation in that. And, you know, that again is another philosophy. But if everybody thinks that way, you know, not just, you know, even from the lowest employee of, you know, hey, I got into this, but I really want to do something else. Okay, cool. Career is a stepping stone. Life works that way. Do you want to do it by hopping from company to company to company to company? Because I can tell you, I'm going to look at your resume and have a whole lot of questions if that's the case. Or do you want to do it within the same company and grow as far as you can? And if you can't anymore, that's their problem. You know, so that kind of butts up against both of them again. You know, and like you were talking about, Tom, is, you know, part of it is the company or manager's responsibility. Part of it is the employee's responsibility for looking at that and being able to think that way. So just as much as managers should look at, appreciate, and be able to deal with employees at that level, just the same, I think that consultants or employees, you know, whichever way you want to look at, but engineers should look at things beyond just the, here's what I do, period.
Yeah, I really like that, Scott. I like the, and this is a place where engineers can help be a part of the solution, right? If you can see the objectives the company is pushing towards, the ones that really matter, the ones that make money, if you can see those as an engineer, then it's going to shake things a little bit because it's not a typical thing, right? But if you can see what the business objectives are and tie your project work into business objectives, then it's far more likely that your own potential is going to be become visible to you and the company. I think where that goes, right?
Yeah. So I'm just sitting here fascinated because, you know, you normally don't hear Scott Morris talk about as a manager.
Well, I mean, you know, is it different than me getting up in front of a couple hundred people at Cisco Live and teaching them something?
Yes.
It is. No, not really.
So, but I want to go back to something I said in the very beginning. How much of this is attitude in the IT industry, not just coming out of management? Because I hear it all the time. Engineers are totally replaceable. And you said something interesting about that in the very beginning, Tom, that I want to scoot back to in a bit. But the other thing is, how much of this is because we do try to put metrics on everything? We're engineers, right? We care about how fast routing protocol converges. So why shouldn't we care how fast somebody can code a particular project or care about, you know, how many bugs per lines of code they produce or something like that? How much of that is just because
are we using Microsoft standards or whose standards?
Yes. Well, no, in this case, then it's, instead of, you know, how you have some cars that are miles per gallon and you have some cars that are gallons per mile. You have some coders who
So you can be an engineer that looks really good, but.
But yeah, you have to reverse the matrix. But I mean, how much of that comes out of our concept of just being able to measure things accurately and understand them rather than just saying it's a person? I don't know. What do you think, Tom?
I think the DevOps people have a pretty good handle on this. There's the certain segment of the DevOps population that is starting to talk a lot more about instrumenting and measuring an organization as opposed to a platform. You know, you see people talking about things like what kind of metrics can you get out of your software, out of your version control system. There's some things you can learn in there about how, you know, how the organization is working. The whole idea of Conway's law, right? That organization, the software ends up looking like the organization that produced it. If that's true, then you can go back to the machine that helped you build the software and you can find organizational patterns. Like, I think that there's some really interesting stuff the DevOps people could teach us about that.
But is that positive? That's my question. Is it good to get into that mode?
I don't know. I think in the attitude of like the blameless postmortem, the idea is to project what you're measuring as the thing in front of you. Kind of like the philosophy, as I understand it, is it's not that there's two people sitting across the table looking at each other. It's that there's two people on the same side of the table looking at the problem. And I think if that's the attitude and the tack that you take, then yeah, that can be nothing but positive. As soon as you start looking at a person and measuring a person, that's a problem. But I think if you can measure like an aggregate, a performance of a team, then maybe you can get useful things out of that still without, you know,
so
trying to turn this into
okay
machines.
To be the guy in the team who doesn't do anything. See, this goes back to like group projects in school. I hate those.
Yeah.
You're right. It is one of those things that you're not going to be able to magically solve or do anything with that. Ross, you were kind of touching on the, I guess, underlying, it sounded anyway, like the underlying philosophy of these are people. If it's a person, though, who is not performing a job, then does it make a difference? I mean, this is not an altruistic thing. We're not here for welfare is really not the right word for it, but I mean you get the idea. We're not here to carry people along just because.
Right.
Everybody has to contribute, and the more people can contribute, hopefully people observe that enough and find ways to compensate, reward, grow, do whatever.
Well, but going back to the turn of the century or so, I'm going to dive into my philosophy here for a second and my philosophical background just for a second. There is this whole thing around Taylorism, or what was called Taylorite philosophies, mm-hmm. which was you would go onto a factory floor and you would figure out how to measure every individual step a person took in performing a particular action. And then you would go out and figure out, how do I modify their routine so that I can make them perform more quickly? So the machine becomes the driver of the person. The person has to shape their life and their actions around the machine. And I understand this to some degree for having the ability to be more efficient, right? I mean, I do this. I change my workflow around tools. We all do this. We change our workflows around tools.
But we're not mass producing things.
Okay. So your response to that is?
The thought process is different. I mean, I get where you're going with it. And we can look at efficiency for stuff, but let's go with the DevOps guys. Okay. I mean, any coder that I've ever met, once the guy knows how to code, or girl, once the person knows how to code and they have a style for doing it, you're not going to be changing that. you can have particular tasks in there, but the methodology of how the brain works to get whatever that output is, that part's already set. So once you get somebody in that position, my view is that ship has sailed in terms of thought process, or at least overall thought process.
Yeah, and Taylorism, like the studies have been conducted for a long time since Taylor, and it works for things that are repetitive and manual, and things that are, for lack of a better term, automatable. Sure, you can get lots of efficiency out of people by telling them, move your finger 2 inches and do it exactly the way that I say.
Well, we had a whole big thing back in the 90s, the process engineers. That was exactly that, that blew up back then. As everybody wanted to find the efficiencies of doing stuff. I think they used a lot of that premise in Office Space to generate a lot of humor.
Yeah. But the workloads that we're undertaking are nothing like that, right? These require high degree of cognitive capability to do this kind of work. It is not an assembly line. And Taylorism just doesn't apply.
I think it depends, right? Configuring routers in CLI or automating router configuration could be seen as just a process that you do.
But what are you, though? Are you the architect of the car, or are you the guy who is building that each individual car?
Right. And that's what I was going to say. In order to continue to add value, and in order to continue to do what's interesting, you as an engineer have to climb the stack.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
You have to climb the stack towards the business. If you see layer one as being Ethernet, I'm not saying Ethernet doesn't add value. Peter Jones is going to kill me if I say Ethernet engineers don't add value.
Yeah, you already started wars that you did not intend to.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be hearing from Peter really soon now. But I'm not saying that's true, but I'm just saying that even in that case, you're adding value not by going and doing punchdowns. You're adding value by learning about Ethernet and making Ethernet a better protocol. Right? So you're still climbing the stack in some sense. And I think that's something that we have to learn as engineers, is it's not just about learning new skills. It's also about learning how to climb the stack, get closer to the business in some sense, so that you're adding value to the business. And I think Tom said something about this as well earlier.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of undiscovered business value in the engineer that is trying to climb the stack. And, part of the issues are, organizations that don't know how to deal with engineers that are climbing the stack. If they don't know what to do with them, that can manifest in, you know, some really interesting and not always positive ways. And that's the part where I feel like you see people leaving companies all the time. They're like, I wanted to do this better, and I wanted to, you know, do such and such, but the company just didn't know how to make it possible for me to do that. So then I moved on to some other company, and the company they left lost a lot of talent, and now they have to pay to replace that person and all these things.
Yeah. But here's the chicken egg portion of that is, do you first solve that problem at the engineering level and tell people to, you know, how to motivate themselves, how to grow themselves, how to, we'll call it, market themselves the same way, whether internally or externally, or do you solve it at the management level and tell them how to pay attention beyond the end of their nose, you know, or get their head out of whatever orifice that happens to be in order to see exactly what's going on. And that really does, like I said, become the kind of the chicken and egg argument over which has to come first.
Right. Right. Well, I think the good news is whoever decides to start, whether it's a business leader or whether it's an individual engineer, I think it's only a positive result if you decide I want to do something a little better for my people, if you're a leader, or for myself. But it's going to, in both cases, it's going to generate discomfort. And especially if you're like a business leader that is trying to do some of this stuff for the first time, just, you know, expect to be uncomfortable, but it's okay. That's how we get better.
It's a risk reward.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So there's this whole concept out there called the open organization I read about all the time. Do you think that fits into this in some way? Has anybody else had an experience with the open organization concept?
No, I've never heard of it. Can you explain it?
It's just a different way of doing business. It's much more around fixing the problem, not the blame. You know, all the same things we talk about with using Agile, applying Agile to more processes, using, you know, doing postmortems correctly. I think postmortems are hilarious, by the way, because 99% of the time, postmortems are everybody sitting in a room trying to figure out how not to blame one another, because they know in the next postmortem, they could be the one getting blamed, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what it is. It's like all these people sitting around a room. How can I not blame? How can I not make it too bad, but yet still be able to say to my manager, I learned something from this process, so I can change some little thing around the edge? I mean, postmortems, frankly, in the modern world, I mean, whatever. I understand the point, but do we even do them right? Most of the time, I don't think we do them right, so we don't.
But that brings up kind of the interesting point, though, is, you know, and this is, again, how – I know you enjoy making fun of me as management, that's okay. But how I've always tried to push engineers is that I'm not interested in pointing a finger and blaming, saying, you screwed this up. What I am interested in is you telling me something got screwed up. If you did it, that's fine too. But more importantly, how are you going to fix it? You know, because it's not, you know, I don't have a problem with people making mistakes. And I've managed in organizations before where I had to take over for people who really, that's all that they did, is everybody was basically just so scared and heads down to not make a mistake because of everybody, you know, how they were treated because of it. I don't care if you make a mistake. I care in how you solve it. And I really would prefer you make new and exciting mistakes, not the same one over and over again. But, you know, that kind of thinking for stuff really, again, I think points towards the management side of it. You know, if your focus in the postmortem, if how you've structured that leads everybody to focus on what words am I going to specifically pick to make sure that I don't get my ass handed me the next time this comes around when I did that, is a problem, because that's not going to help people learn from their mistakes. It's just going to help everybody be nice to each other and pat them on the back and say, it's okay, don't worry about it. And that's not what you want to do. You want to fix problems. You want the customer not to, you know, see problems, or at least to see that this occurred, we dealt with it, it's more positive now, here's what happened and here's what we do. But you want it to be a learning experience all around. You know, and I don't know, to me that should come top down.
Yeah,
in terms of, you know, where your push is, where your focus is for it.
Which then comes back to the question of how do you stop underperformance if you don't make the postmortem? at least to some degree, about saying you screwed up. Don't do that again.
Right.
How often, though, is your postmortem because of underperformance?
Oh, as opposed to overperformance?
Well, okay. So if you're driving your car down the road and you blow a spark plug, are you underperforming or did you have a problem?
Sure, sure. You're saying,
or are you driving too fast?
Only if you're caught.
Only if you're caught.
Well, that gets into how do complex systems fail, right? Because they generally, I don't know, it's not the work of one person that causes a complex system to fail, usually.
Yeah, very rarely. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It comes down to unintended consequences. And a lot of times what you should be looking for in a postmortem, in my opinion, is not how to change your processes necessarily, but how to change your system. Because no amount of process in the world is going to solve a systemic problem or a problem embedded in the system.
No.
You just can't fix it, right? You know, the old joke about the guy with the hammer hitting in the place at the right place. Well, I'm sorry, but if it takes a guy with a hammer hitting in the right place, your system's broken. And you need to fix the system, honestly.
Yeah. Big enough hammer, I mean. There's no problem that can't be solved with a suitable application of explosives.
So management lessons from Scott.
Just blow stuff up.
It must be from working with the Marines. I don't know.
Wow. So I think that's a pretty good place to wrap up because I think we've covered it pretty well. I don't think there's much else that I could actually ask Scott other than, you know, what's up with the lobotomy man doing the management thing?
He said it. He went there.
So it's all because of the everything I learned for what I didn't want to do in management was from the last managers that I've had. No.
I see.
It's finding ways to do something better and enjoy it. And what I realize, or really what a couple of us, because Donnie and I both formed the company. And there's two of us, and when we started, it was just two of us, and we're great and everything was working great and we have no problems, you know, marketing or scaling or doing anything like that until we get to scaling. Okay. You know, two people can only scale so far. So at some point in time, based on wanting to, you know, my motivation for doing more and doing more interesting things and getting out there had to kind of grow with that. And so therefore I became a manager.
Okay. Interesting. That's a sad story, but okay.
It's a fun story. Come on.
But you know, there it is.
I am not just doing management. Thank you very much. So it is not a full lobotomy. It's only a partial lobotomy.
Awesome.
I still do architecture work. Still have a good time.
So Tom, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at Tom Ammon and LinkedIn at the same.
Okay. And no blog post yet. It's every show. Man, look, you got a whole bookshelf full of books back there. Just pick one out and copy stuff. So, Scott, just not any.
And particularly if the author says Russ Wright, he'll be like, this is greatly written, but boy, does it sound familiar.
So, Scott, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Scott Morris, CCIE. Otherwise, I'm on LinkedIn as SW Morris.
Okay, awesome. Well, thanks for coming on The Hedge, Scott, and we'll catch you next time. We'll find some other topic to bring you on about.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me. It's been great.
Yep. Thanks.
Subscribe to The Hedge on your favorite podcast service or follow along at rule11.tech.